Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight to this lecture. For me, it's always a pleasure to come back to LSE. I say come back because I obtained my LLB as a UC student, I hasten to say, on this evening, which is associated with the alumni of LSE. And in those days, those who studied law, as I did, used to spend their time perambulating between University College, King's, and LSE. You used to go where you felt you could find the most glittering star in the legal galaxy to entertain you. The richness of choice in those days was immense. And for a student from another faculty, I spent a great deal of my time at LSE. I was attracted by what Carol Harlow describes as LSE's alternative tradition, pioneering the study of law in the context of law in society and the social sciences. That being my background, I regard it as a singular honor to be invited back to chair one of these centenary lectures in the series Law and Society. I've already benefited from one of these lectures, possibly more than I benefited from the lectures I attended in my student days, and that was the one given by Sir Anthony Mason, the former Chief Justice of Australia, just a few days ago. As you know, our lecturer tonight is LSE's Professor of Law, Michael Zander. Michael, as I know him as a friend, personifies in many minds the strength of the contribution that LSE has made to the development of the law. Many areas of the law have been subjected to his dispassionate and analytical examination. He's been particularly unswerving in his examining of how both the criminal and civil justice systems work in practice. As a trial judge, I was immensely grateful for the results of his scrutiny of PACE, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. It was no surprise to those who know him that he should have been selected as a member of the Royal Commission on Criminal Justice, nor that he should have been the inspiration of the research that added to the authority of the report which the Commission made. Indeed, it may also not have been a surprise to those who know Michael as well as I do that he should have set out clearly and succinctly the reasons why he could not entirely endorse the views expressed on all the subjects by the members of the Commission. It's one of the characteristics of Michael that I admire immensely, that if he is dissatisfied with the approach adopted by others, he courageously does his duty and makes his dissent clear, irrespective of the fact that the person concerned, who was the author who's subject to his criticism, may not particularly welcome his comments. It's this last quality of Michael's that I am looking forward, because of this last quality, that I'm looking forward to what he has to say tonight, with some trepidation. Some of the audience may know that a certain interim report was issued recently, which bears a singularly similar title to that of Michael's lecture. For the purposes of the road shows, which were conducted in conjunction with that report, the first speaker who was selected to speak at the London Roadshow, or rather the first London Roadshow, was no less than Michael Zander. This was despite the fact that he courteously indicated to me beforehand that he was, with reluctance, going to have to express a forceful note of dissent about the whole process upon which I was engaged. Michael's contribution on that day was a powerful one and gave me much food for thought, from which I thought I'd benefited. But when Michael was sent a copy of the report, he thanked me equally courteously and then indicated that he was far from satisfied with what I had to say. I look forward to now hearing Michael Zander's reasons for this and what his recipe would be for ensuring access to justice in the next century. Michael Zander.
It's an honor to have been asked to give this lecture during the LSE's centennial celebrations and to play a part thereby in marking so auspicious an occasion for this great institution. I've worked happily at the school for 32 years, which is therefore just about a third of the century we are celebrating. My pleasure is the greater because of the identity of the chairman, Lord Wolfe, who is universally regarded as one of the most significant legal figures of the day. He does me and the occasion the honor of presiding, despite, so far as I know, having no personal connection with the school other than being Pro-Chancellor of the University of London. I've deliberately chosen a broad title as my topic. It seems appropriate in a centennial lecture in the approach to the millennium to attempt to paint on a large canvas. The topic embraces a great array of major issues, any one of which could itself be the subject of a lecture. In the past 20 to 30 years, a vast literature on these issues has developed. A lecture, inevitably, is a very inadequate way to treat so rich and complex a subject. My purpose is to see where we are and where we're going in regard to access to justice, and to focus attention especially on the difficulty and complexity of the subject, which sometimes receives less attention than it should. By the phrase access to justice, I understand the whole array of issues that relate to the citizen's ability to cope in the face of the law and the legal system in terms of getting one's rights at law and of defending one's legal position. The subject is one on which I find myself in a state of basic ambivalence. On the one hand, one wants people to get their legal rights. So I am concerned that, according to the research, the majority of the population, regardless of age, income, or social class, are woefully ignorant about their rights, that a great proportion of those entitled to legal aid do not know about its existence, that the great majority of victims of accidents do nothing to get compensation. In short, that there is a great unmet need for legal help. Plainly, something should be done to reduce their ignorance and to make it easier for them to get their legal just deserts. At the same time, I am uneasy at the notion that the citizen should be encouraged to reach for his lawyer like a frontiersman in the Wild West reaching for his six-shooter. A few weeks ago, the Times published a letter about a recent study in Pennsylvania of 30,000 hospital records, which the writer said showed only one person in 65 injured by the negligence of a doctor or other health worker filed suit for compensation. And that was in allegedly trigger-happy America. Do we say that society would be improved if most of the 65 had sued to get a remedy? Is that our definition of a good society? I suggest that we should be slow to conclude that a potentially successful action unbrought or unattended to is necessarily a failure of access to justice. But if one asks how to distinguish between potentially successful cases that should be encouraged and those that should not, there is no easy answer. Sometimes one might get agreement that legal proceedings should have been brought or defended in terms of the need of the individual, balanced against some sense of a wider social utility. But very often, I imagine, that such agreement could not be reached. A recent newspaper headline read, "Compensation claims flood into the Ministry of Defense." The story accompanying the headline reported that the ministry was inundated with compensation claims from servicemen and women alleging training injuries, sex discrimination, equal rights abuses, and war-related illness. It expected, for instance, to pay £50 million, an average of £100,000 each, to 5,000 women who had lodged claims on account of being dismissed after becoming pregnant. Is all this an increase in access to justice and desirable? Or is it an increase in just access to justice and undesirable? Do we want more of it or less of it? I merely pose the question and suggest that ambivalence is an appropriate response. When it comes to cost and delay, the position at first sight seems more straightforward. Surely, cost and delay in legal proceedings are by definition bad and should be reduced. But even here, the issues are not entirely straightforward. If cost or delay are reduced by little, it will make no significant difference. Those who were deterred before from taking legal proceedings by cost considerations or concern about the length of cases will still be deterred. If, on the other hand, costs and delay are reduced by a great deal, one needs to ask what has been jettisoned to make that possible. Has one lost something of real value in the process of pursuing the objective of reducing cost and delay? In a study by the Rand Corporation of different alternative methods for handling cases in a number of jurisdictions, the authors concluded that neither cost nor delay, nor even the result of the case, was critical to litigant satisfaction. What was critical to satisfaction was perceived fairness. The moral is that the pursuit of access to justice which sacrifices justice, or even a sense of justice, can be bought at too high a price. When people fail to use the law, there are, of course, many kinds of reasons. In an American study in the 1970s, Stuart Macaulay looked at the behavior of businessmen who had contractual disputes. He found that although there were elaborate contracts prepared by the lawyers, when it came to a dispute, the businessmen tended to prefer to get on the telephone to try to sort it out without getting the lawyers involved. The businessmen certainly had access to legal advice. Their decision to avoid legal recourse can therefore not be described as a failure of access to justice. As I have already suggested, we should be rather careful before we characterize unwillingness to use legal remedies as a failure of the system. It could even in a certain sense be a success of the system. If going to law and lawyers is often the opposite of beneficial to the citizen, perhaps cost and delay and other features of the law and the legal system that we usually regard as negative factors play a part in creating an appropriate distaste for taking up the legal cudgels. With those cautionary words about some of the ambiguities of the subject, let me say something about the access to justice seen in England in the mid-1990s. The first thing to note is that access to justice is nowadays a subject to which serious people pay attention. It was not always so. When I first became interested in these issues in the 1960s, it was a topic that concerned a few critics of the system, but not the legal political establishment. So far as the establishment was concerned, we had the best legal aid system in the world, and there was little further that needed to be done to give citizens access to justice. The idea that there was a significant unmet need for legal services was derided. Today, the position is totally different. When the Clarion call sounds, those who come forward to do battle in the name of access to justice are not just the Legal Action Group and its supporters. They are as likely to include the chairman of the bar, the president of the Law Society, the National Consumer Council, the Consumers Association, the National Association of Citizens Advice Bureaus, and other such like dignified persons and bodies. This is a great advance. The credit for changing what might be called the conversation about access to justice is shared between many people and bodies. But I would like to acknowledge in particular the role played over 25 years by the Legal Action Group through its bulletin, its books and reports, its conferences and training courses, not to speak of the work of many former LAG committee members in the law, the civil service, and academic life. I would mention also the role of the Lord Chancellor's Legal Aid Advisory Committee, now most regrettably axed by the Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay, on the ground that since he has the Legal Aid Board, he doesn't need an advisory committee. I must say that if I were Lord Chancellor, I would want independent advice from a broadly based committee able to assess the problems of access to justice from a wider perspective than is available to any one actor, even one so important as the Legal Aid Board. The next Labour Lord Chancellor should re-establish this valuable institution. In the meanwhile, the Legal Aid Board should do what the Advisory Committee used to do and convene an annual conference of experts and interested parties and bodies to assess the needs of the moment. What then is the current position? We have a truly remarkable legal aid scheme, which, though far from perfect, possibly is the best in the world. It covers civil proceedings in all the courts, criminal proceedings in all the courts, advice and assistance on any kind of legal problem. It provides a free, non-means-tested service in police stations and duty solicitor schemes in magistrates' courts. In 1994-95, the Legal Aid Board paid for no fewer than 3.4 million acts of assistance to individuals, to which must be added another 100,000 or so defendants receiving legal aid in the Crown Courts, for which the Board is not responsible. 3.5 million legal aid matters in a year represents a major contribution to the promotion of access to justice. Most firms of solicitors do some legal aid work, providing over 11,000 access points to citizens around the country. Contrary to the position in many countries, the choice of lawyer for legal aid work is for the client, not the court or the legal aid authorities. Also, contrary to the position in most other countries, legal aid work is done not just by young lawyers, but by lawyers at all levels of seniority. The most striking illustration is that of cases in the Crown Court, which deals with all serious cases. 99% of defendants in the Crown Court are on legal aid, an astonishing statistic, unequaled, I think, anywhere in the world. It means that when they are acting for the defence, the entire criminal bar, from its most senior members down, are virtually always appearing for legally aided clients. The current total net legal aid budget, including administration costs, is of the order of £1.3 billion. One of the most important strengths of the scheme is that it is, and always has been, demand-led. Every citizen who qualifies on the merits test and the means test has a right to get legal aid. No one has ever had to be turned away on the ground that the money has run out. As many here will know, that fundamental principle is now under the gravest threat. For years now, Lord Chancellors, doubtless under pressure from the Treasury, have been talking of the rising cost of legal aid. It's perfectly true that the cost has risen significantly, and until recently, well ahead of inflation. There are a variety of conflicting explanations for the phenomenon. Lord Mackay's often expressed concern about the cost of the scheme has now culminated in his recent green paper, Legal Aid Targeting Need, in which he proposes that there should be a cash limit on legal aid expenditure. This would drastically change the legal aid scheme, and I will, of course, return to this matter. Legal services to the indigent are provided not only by lawyers in private practice, but by lawyers and others working in the 50 or so law centres. Law centres do invaluable work in providing a range of legal services to the poor and give excellent value for money. As someone who was much involved in the original battle to get the concept of law centres accepted in this country, I have no doubt that there should be many more of them. It looks as if the Labour Party intends to include that aim in its programme. In addition to the services provided by lawyers in private practice and law centres, there are in this country a great variety of advice agencies providing free services, both generalist, of which the citizens' advice bureaus are the most important, and specialist, notably in the fields of housing, debt and welfare rights. There are some 1,500 CAB outlets, giving the movement a presence in almost every town and city. They provide free advice to all comers on a vast array of topics. On the latest figures for 1993-94, CABs dealt with some 7.5 million inquiries from over 5 million people at a cost of a mere £6 per inquiry. It's been estimated that something between a third and a half of the matters dealt with by the CABs are legal problems, or at least have a legal component. In the entire Citizens Advice Bureau movement, which has some 27,000 workers, there are only 12 or so salaried lawyers. The advisers, in other words, are lay people, about 90% of them volunteers, with only a limited amount of training. Yet there seems to be a high level of satisfaction with the quality of the advice they give. The community is extraordinarily fortunate to have this major resource. If all of these are currently the main means available to help secure access to justice, what are the chief issues? There can be no question that in July 1995, two great issues dominate the scene, both of which cast their shadow forward to the coming years. They are reform of the legal aid system in the light of the government's green paper, and reform of the civil justice system in the light of the report of our chairman, Lord Wolfe, actually entitled, as he indicated, Access to Justice. I must, of course, say something about both of these. The most immediate is the Legal Aid Green Paper, on which views are requested by the end of next month. To summarize my view, it is that implementation of the Green Paper would cause incalculable harm to the legal aid scheme and would seriously diminish access to justice. The Lord Chancellor's proposal is that there should be an overall predetermined annual budget for legal aid expenditure. The money would be given, probably to the Legal Aid Board, for allocation according to priorities set by the government and approved by Parliament. Priorities would be in general terms, indicating how resources should be distributed between different areas of law. The board would enter into contracts with providers, who might be lawyers or non-lawyers, who would agree to provide specified services over a specified period for a global sum agreed in advance. Block contracts would cover the type, quality, volume, and price of services to be provided. This proposal is open to many serious objections. Let me itemize a few, 12 to be exact, by way of example. One. Neither the government nor Parliament can sensibly set priorities in regard to the allocation of legal aid as between different areas of law. Priorities arise from what human beings need, not what the government says they need. On what basis could the government, the Legal Aid Board, or anyone else specify in advance the percentage of money to be allocated to criminal cases, personal injury cases, housing or matrimonial matters, social welfare, etc.? Of course, such decisions can be made, but there should be no pretense that they are anything but arbitrary. Two, the setting of a predetermined annual budget means that there must be rationing to ensure that the budget is not overspent. The rationing of legal aid is an attack on access to justice. It means that people who are eligible for legal aid on the means test and the merits test will be told that they cannot have it, because there is insufficient money. The Green Paper admits as much when it acknowledges that it might not be possible to apply the idea of a fixed and predetermined budget to criminal legal aid. I quote, "The government believes that any new system for criminal legal aid would have to ensure that no case would be refused for lack of money alone. It's conceded, therefore, that in civil cases, a shortage of money alone could be the basis for refusal of legal aid." Three, the possibility that a cap on legal aid expenditure might extend to criminal cases is a public scandal. Defendants in criminal cases do not choose to be prosecuted. If they qualify for legal aid according to the statutory interests of justice test and the means test, how could it be justified to deny legal aid on the ground that the budget holder has run out of money? Quite apart from anything else, the European Convention on Human Rights states that everyone has the minimum right, quote, to defend himself in person or through legal assistance of his own choosing, or, if he has not sufficient means to pay for legal assistance, to be given it free when the interests of justice so require. The Green Paper quotes this phrase from Article 6, but nevertheless says that, I quote, "The government considers that the balance of argument is in favour of setting a predetermined budget for criminal legal aid. It is not revealed how this could be reconciled with the provisions of Article 6. Four, it's predictable that sooner or later, and probably sooner, the government will use the availability of a cash-limited system to reduce the total amount of money available for legal aid, as has happened in both New South Wales and Victoria in 1992, and has happened repeatedly in the United States. The Lord Chancellor has said that this is not a cost-cutting exercise. I imagine that we will not have to wait very long to discover that he has misinformed us. Five, the decision as to who gets legal aid in civil cases would be made by solicitors. At present, this decision is made by the legal aid authorities on objective grounds, after assessment of the applicant's grounds for taking or defending the proceedings and his means. The solicitor would now also have to take into account whether the firm could afford to take the client's case, having regard to its likely cost in the light of the firm's block grant from the Legal Aid Board. Solicitors would naturally be tempted to favour cases that maximise their profit margin, thus creating a serious conflict of interest problem between the client and the lawyer. Six, even ignoring self-interest in caseload selection, on what basis is the solicitor supposed to decide that one client who has grounds to take or to defend legal proceedings should be permitted to do so, and another should not? There is no objective measure one could apply. From the client's point of view, it would be a total lottery. If a client cannot find any local solicitor to take his case for lack of money, what's he supposed to do? Would there even be some form of appeal against the refusal to take a legal aid case? Seven, block grants from the Legal Aid Board will be subject to competitive tendering, with obvious risks to standards of service. The tendency will be to accept the lowest bids. The Legal Aid Board will not be able to prevent corner cutting by firms, each naturally trying to make the best profit it can on its allocated budget. An example would be use of a barrister. One would hope that a solicitor would bring in a barrister if the case required one. But if the solicitor has a financial incentive in not using a barrister, how is the Legal Aid Board to know whether a barrister was not used for valid reasons or simply in order to maximise the solicitor's profit? Worse, from the client's point of view, is that his range of choice of solicitor will be significantly reduced. Legal aid payments are currently made to some 11,000 solicitors' offices, of which about 1,000 have franchises from the Legal Aid Board. But the other 10,000 firms which do not have franchises can still supply legal aid services. In Lord Mackay's brave new world, that will change. The board thinks that there are likely to be some 3,000 firms with full franchises able to receive long-term block contracts, plus another unspecified number, possibly 1,000 to 2,000 firms, and not solicitors firms and non-solicitor advice agencies, that would not have full franchises but would be entitled to short-term contracts. That represents a drastic reduction in the number of solicitors' firms able to do legal aid work. From the public's point of view, a reduction of legal aid outlets on that scale would represent a massive, I would say, catastrophic loss in terms of access to justice. Nine, it would also give a wholly spurious significance to the board's franchising. The elaborate procedures involved in getting a franchise may or may not represent a guarantee of better quality work. That is still a matter of controversy. But refusing to allow firms to do legal aid work unless they've been approved by the board is to give its quality assurance far too much importance. Seeking to improve the standards of the profession by franchising may be in the public interest. Depriving the public of thousands of access points for legal aid services by firms of solicitors is not. 10. Moreover, the Green Paper says that franchises would be restricted to particular categories of work, so that a client who had a multifaceted problem, where part was and part was not covered by the franchise, might find himself having to go for that aspect of his problem to another firm. A hopelessly inefficient and wasteful system, and another blow for access to justice. The Green Paper contemplates the franchising of non-solicitor agencies such as citizens' advice bureaus and other advice services, especially for social welfare problems. That is excellent. But it could be done, and should long since have been done, under the existing scheme. Indeed, the Legal Aid Board is currently engaged in an imaginative research program to test the way in which the board could fund non-lawyer advisory agencies. This therefore requires no reform of the legal aid system, let alone the drastic measures envisaged in the Green Paper. 12. The scheme will conveniently enable the Lord Chancellor to escape responsibility for any decision regarding allocation of funds. He will always be able to wash his hands of the matter by saying that the decision was taken by the board, or by the local committee, or by the actual provider at the coalface. This is the scheme that the government presents as an improvement in access to justice. You will gather that I speak on this matter more in anger than in sorrow. There is, in fact, only one reason for this Green Paper: control of the legal aid budget. It may be that the Treasury must be obeyed, but the Lord Chancellor can hardly be surprised if his unconvincing presentation of his proposals as an improvement in terms of access to justice receives the treatment it deserves. The first line of the Green Paper states, I quote, "The aim of the government is to improve access to justice," close quote. Anne Abraham, chief executive of the National Association of Citizens Advice Bureaus, referred to this statement when she spoke about the Green Paper recently. I quote, "This will not be achieved, and public confidence in the system will not be restored by limiting the total amount of money available. Cash limiting the budget will simply lead to the sort of gross injustices we have seen under the social fund. People competing for the limited resources available and being denied legal aid, either because the money has run out or because funds need to be preserved in case a better case comes along later in the year." That assessment of the likely impact of the Green Paper is the view not of lawyers, who could lose from the new scheme, but of the citizens' advice bureaus, which are likely to do well out of it. I believe that the idea of a cash limit on legal aid expenditure must be fiercely resisted. It was gratifying to hear the Shadow Lord Chancellor, Lord Irvine, say in public in June that the Labour Party was not in favour of a cash limit on legal aid, though the effect was somewhat qualified by his subsequent statement that the Labour Party also thought that there would be no more money available for legal aid. It was not clear how these two statements could be reconciled. One accepts, of course, that there is a need for due economy in the system, and that there is room for tightening up in various directions to reduce waste of public monies. There are a variety of measures that could be taken to help to keep the rise in legal aid costs under control. The extension of standard fees and the proposed steps to deal with the problem of apparently wealthy people getting legal aid are examples. In fact, the steep rise of legal aid costs of recent years seems recently to have flattened out, so maybe the problem is already in course of solving itself. For the past 2 years, the legal aid budget has actually been underspent. In 1996-97, legal aid expenditure is expected to rise by only 2%. The proportion of the population eligible for legal aid has been reducing, from something like 70% of households at the end of the 1970s to something like 50% today. One definitely would not wish it to see it decline further. On the contrary, but if the choice is between reducing the proportion of the population eligible for legal aid even further or imposing a cash limit on legal aid expenditure, I would reluctantly reduce eligibility limits
and retain the demand-led element for those within the scheme who, by definition, would always be those in greatest need. Since 1973, one way to get access to justice in the civil courts has been by using the special procedure for small claims. The scope of this facility has expanded from claims of up to £75 in 1973 to claims today of up to £1,000. Any claim within the limit is automatically assigned to the small claims procedure unless special circumstances apply. Lord Wolfe has recommended that the limit be raised to £3,000 for all cases except personal injury ones, and this recommendation has already been accepted by the Lord Chancellor. Is this good or bad for access to justice? It sounds wholly good. One can bring a small claim without a lawyer. There's not the usual risk of having to pay the other side's costs if one loses. The hearing is in private. The rules of evidence are relaxed. It should therefore be reasonably user-friendly. But there is also a downside. First, although the chief purpose of the small claim system is to encourage individuals to go to law, in practice, the majority of plaintiffs using it have always been companies and small businesses. In the 1988 study done for the Civil Justice Review, the ratio was 58% business plaintiffs as compared with 38% individual plaintiffs. That seems to be a worldwide phenomenon in small claims courts. It will presumably continue to be so. Indeed, with the enlargement of the jurisdiction, the proportion of business plaintiffs may even increase. It's difficult in cases within the small claims limit to get permission to take the case through the ordinary court system, one purpose of which would be to become eligible for legal aid. One does not need to be especially cynical to deduce that the prospect of removing legal aid from a considerable swathe of cases was the reason why the Lord Chancellor was so quick to implement Lord Wolfe's proposal that the limit be raised. The result is that litigants who are unable to manage without a lawyer in, say, housing cases, will be denied the possibility of having one, and in practice might therefore not bring their cases at all, or have to bring them without the essential legal support of a solicitor. In terms of access to justice, that would be the opposite of an advance. For those who do not qualify for legal aid and who do not have some form of insurance against legal costs, or the help of a trade union, the prospect of bringing ordinary legal proceedings are notoriously less good. Indeed, it's become conventional wisdom that for them, justice is more or less out of reach. In reality, this common enough view is a bit exaggerated. If the case is taken through the ordinary courts and there are good prospects of success, it can be brought in the expectation that one will get one's damages, or whatever other remedy is being sought, and have most of one's costs paid by the other side. Of course, one can never be sure that one will win, but in practice, a very high proportion of those who take proceedings do succeed, usually without a court hearing, by way of a settlement which provides for the plaintiff to be paid most of his costs, sometimes all of his costs. But in some instances, a potential litigant is discouraged from taking legal proceedings by the fear that if he loses, he will have to pay both his own and his opponent's costs. Such would-be litigants may be interested in the new possibility of making a no-win, no-fee agreement with the solicitors, known as a conditional fee agreement. This new system came into effect, as many of you will have seen, just last week. Again, this sounds attractive. My worry about conditional fees is that often the client will not realize that he is paying his lawyer a success fee, which was unnecessary, because in so many cases the lawyer is taking little or no risk. Much worse, the client will sometimes find that most or even the whole of his damages are taken by his lawyer because the percentage is based on the costs, not on the damages. So the whole of the damages are at risk. It's very regrettable that the Lord Chancellor did not agree to impose a cap on the proportion of damages that can be taken by the lawyer. To its credit, the Law Society has recommended a cap of 25% in its model agreement. But there's no compulsion on solicitors to follow the recommendation, and it would be naive to assume that they all will do so. I turn now to reform of civil procedure and to Lord Wolfe's very important report. Unlike the Lord Chancellor's Green Paper, which has been almost universally condemned, Lord Wolfe's report has been almost universally welcomed. For my part, I salute the scale and scope of the vision that informs the report. There can be no doubt that valuable reform will flow from this exercise, starting with a much-needed simplification of the rules of procedure, which was the initial subject of the remit given to Lord Wolfe by the Lord Chancellor. But as you know, my Lord Chairman, and as you have already indicated in your kind, unduly kind opening remarks, I find myself in the uncomfortable position of being one of the very few people who have real reservations about the basic thrust of the report. The central recommendation is the first of the 124 made in the report. I quote, "There should be a fundamental transfer in the responsibility for the management of civil litigation from litigants and their legal advisers to the courts." Close quote. The court would establish a timetable to which the parties would be required to adhere. There would be a no-frills fast track with a hearing restricted to 3 hours, fixed at the outset for a date 20 to 30 weeks later. In the bigger or more difficult cases, there would be hands-on pre-trial management hearings to knock the case into shape for the trial. The proposed new system would require a complete change of attitude on the part of the judges, which would, I think, be extremely difficult to achieve. They would also need to be trained in management skills that, at present, few judges possess. To make the proposed new system work would require considerable extra resources, especially in the form of information technology, more judges, and more court staff. I would be very surprised indeed if these resources proved to be forthcoming from the Lord Chancellor's Department. Nor do I think that the extra costs could or should be put upon litigants. The Lord Chancellor's Department has recently enunciated what seems to me the highly objectionable theory that the costs of the courts should be borne by those who use them. It is not yet government policy that the cost of firefighting services should be borne by those who have fires, or that the costs of the police should be borne by victims of crime. But in regard to the courts, the new doctrine is that the user should pay. This ignores the fact that the whole community benefits from having disputes resolved in an orderly manner and having legal rights clarified and precedents established. The provision of courts is a basic duty of society, for which society as a whole should bear the main burden, just as with roads or schools. Certainly users should pay part of the cost, as they always have and currently do. The idea that they should pay the full cost also ignores the fact that in our system, the person who actually pays court costs is not the person who initiates the proceedings, but the party that loses, who is normally the other side, which largely undermines the philosophy of user pays. There are other problems inherent in Lord Wolfe's concept. I fear that it will involve a good deal of unnecessary and expensive front-loading of costs in regard to cases that settle and would have settled anyway with less cost. For the tiny minority of cases that actually go to trial, the empirical evidence from existing research is that pre-trial court management of cases tends not to achieve the objective of shortening trials. In the past couple of decades, there's been a great deal of experimentation in the United States, particularly, with reforms like those proposed by Lord Wolfe, with disappointingly little positive result. The authors of an Anglo-American report in 1990 gave this gloomy appraisal of the research on such reform initiatives. I quote, "The speed with which cases move does not seem to be influenced by court workload, trial rates, case mix, procedural rules, or judicial involvement in settlement conferences. Indeed, the injection of additional resources intended to accelerate litigation, judges, courtrooms, support staff, has often ended in embarrassing failure. Close quote. Such an all-embracing negative verdict, based on extensive research, discourages confidence that costly procedural reform of the kind urged by the Wolf Report is likely to have an overall beneficial impact. More fundamentally, even if implementation of the Wolf proposals pushed cases through more quickly, how do we know that that is a good thing? We have no research as to what extent delay is a problem. Everyone is against delay, but everyone is also in favor of proper presentation of cases, preparation of cases. Delay is a problem only if it's excessive, having regard to the need to prepare the case properly. We simply do not know what proportion of cases are subject to excessive delay, and therefore whether there is a need for a radical solution such as Lord Wolfe proposes. In the absence of any relevant hard information, I am reluctant to support far-reaching reforms designed to hit so ill-defined a target. In regard to delay in civil cases, I prefer the more modest proposal of the Cantley Committee in 1979, that where a High Court case has not been set down for trial 18 months after issue of the writ, the parties should be asked by the court to explain. There, one is at least dealing only with cases that look as if they may be subject to excessive delay. And even then, in a fair proportion, it would no doubt turn out that the delay was understandable and indeed justifiable. I also have considerable reservations about the idea central to the Wolf Report that the courts and the judges should take over management of the throughput of cases from litigants and their lawyers. My main concern is that I see no sufficient reason why the progress or non-progress of civil litigation should, save at the extremes, be controlled by the courts rather than by the parties. I see civil litigation as a matter essentially for the parties, with the courts there to do justice and to see fair play, and certainly to chivvy if they are unreasonably dragging their feet. I do not regard it as necessarily an improvement in terms of access to justice if the courts, which know little about the litigation, take over. And I seriously question whether litigants will necessarily see it as an improvement. Does salvation lie then in alternative dispute resolution? ADR, as it's called, has become a fashionable topic to which any speaker on access to justice must these days pay attention. Conciliation, arbitration, mediation, alternative adjudication systems, both court annexed and freestanding, ombudsmen, whether statutory or appointed by the industry, are the flavour of the month. There is now a huge literature on the subject. The Lord Chief Justice's acclaimed practice direction of January 1995 actually requires that all parties in cases in the Queen's Bench Division and the Chancery Division be required to complete a pre-trial questionnaire in which they state whether the lawyers have discussed the possibility of ADR with the client. The concept of ADR now has very broad support from the government and other official quarters, from the legal profession and a wide constituency of other interested persons and bodies. There is much to be said in favour of these various techniques for dealing with legal complaints and disputes. This is true both from the point of view of finding cheaper, quicker, and more user-friendly methods than the traditional methods of the courts, and from the point of view of finding ways of handling disputes which are intrinsically better suited to the real needs of the parties. One can therefore broadly, warmly welcome the proliferation of these new techniques for dispute resolution. There is, of course, nothing new about ADR. We've had alternative dispute resolution systems called tribunals for a very long time. Statutory tribunals hear about 6 times as many cases as the High Court and the County Court combined. We've had small claims courts. We've had a network of different kinds of both official and unofficial industry ombudsmen and different categories of inspectorates. They all perform a useful function. I am strongly in favour of extended experimentation with ADR. What one must always have in mind, however, is whether the ADR method in question results in second-class justice for the poor, or in treating less important disputes as not deserving the essential attributes of the justice system, whether it is simply adding another stage to the process of dispute resolution, whether informality of procedure promotes inequality, whether parties are being coerced or manipulated into ADR systems against their will. If courts and judges become part of the ADR system, what effect does that have on the integrity of the judicial system and both the community's and the judge's sense of the judicial role? This is not to say that ADR is to be avoided, but that it is to be introduced with care and, so far as possible, monitored. One problem there is the fact that ADR typically takes place in private, which makes it extremely difficult to find out how it's working. Alternative dispute resolution is in itself neither good nor bad. The question always is how does it work? Does it give satisfaction? Is it quicker or cheaper? And if so, what of importance or value is sacrificed or lost in the process? Experience suggests that ADR will not decrease pressure on the courts. It's probably better to think of ADR as a series of additional rather than alternative means of settling disputes. Chairman, in summing up my approach to the issue of access to justice as we confront it close to the turn of the century, I have three main points to make. The first is that we need to look far and wide for reforms and innovations that will improve access to justice. This is today engaging the attention of experts in many countries. In Australia, for instance, the Commonwealth Attorney General recently had a 500-page report from an advisory committee entitled Access to Justice, an Action Plan. The report made nearly 100 recommendations. In Ontario, there's a major civil justice review underway. In the United States, there continue to be all sorts of initiatives. We need to take advantage of the best thinking in other jurisdictions, as well, of course, as assembling all our own wisdom and ideas. An incoming Labour Lord Chancellor might consider establishing a special task force for a report on what one could call access to justice ideas, worth at least testing. One that I would commend is whether the hitherto somewhat frosty dialogue between Parliamentary Council and the Plain English Campaign could fructify in more user-friendly drafting techniques for statute law. But that is only one example from a long list that one could recite if time permitted. Secondly, we must do something about the lack of research on these issues in this country. The record of the Lord Chancellor's Department in the field of legal system empirical research has been deplorable. Repeatedly to go ahead with reform proposals that are not properly grounded in objective knowledge and real understanding of the systems being reformed is a waste of public money. There have of late been some slightly encouraging signs that this lesson is beginning to be learned. The Lord Chancellor's Department, it seems, will have £250,000 available for research in 1995-96. But to rely on the government to undertake all the research needed would be foolish. We need major academic initiatives. It's heartening to know that the ESRC is considering funding a significant program of research in the area of civil justice, and that the Nuffield Foundation is maintaining its long-standing support for research in this area. There is so much that we need to know if we are to make intelligent assessments of how to reform the system. At present, we have next to no knowledge of the nature of civil litigation or of the nature and extent of the problems with the system that we are trying to solve. We know nothing about the way in which lawyers conduct litigation and virtually nothing about the way in which litigants view the process and why, for instance, so few people with legal problems use either the ordinary courts or the small claims system. We do not even have adequate information about the cost of legal proceedings. No research has been done to measure the impact of the recent reform of pretrial procedure, requiring earlier production of witness statements. Anecdotally, the impression one gets is that the impact has mainly been to increase the cost of litigation through front-loading of costs with little benefit in terms either of more settlements or shorter trials. But we need hard data. No research has been done on the impact of the recent transfer of large numbers of personal injury cases from the High Court to the County Court. One hears that the county courts are struggling in trying to cope. But what, in cost-benefit terms, have been the results for the courts, for the lawyers, for litigants, witnesses, and others affected? No research has been done on another important recent procedural initiative, the draconian rule automatically striking out county court actions which have not been set down within 15 months from the close of pleadings. Yet although we have no information about how these reforms are working, it is now proposed that we should embark on another round of even more major procedural reform based on the Wolf Report. This, I suggest, is not a serious way to proceed. I believe that what is needed is a new academically based centre for the study of access to justice that would get to grips with these and such like issues. I say parenthetically that if such a centre were to be set up, I cannot think of a more appropriate home for it than the London School of Economics, with the range of interests and skills represented in law, sociology, psychology, anthropology, and statistics, to name only the most obvious disciplines. The research that is needed is not simply to explore the issues in advance in order to base reform proposals on solid ground. Research is equally needed to monitor the implementation of reform, which should always, if possible, proceed through pilot schemes. I was glad to see that this point is made too by Lord Wolfe in his report. To establish reforms, and then not as a matter of course, to study whether and if so to what extent they have achieved their aim, is simply unintelligent. My final observation is that it is appropriate to adopt a sceptical approach to all who propose reform, and for that matter, to those who oppose it. This is a field in which confidence in one's prescriptions is frequently shown to have been misplaced. The history of reform of the legal system is littered with proposals that were implemented and went wrong. Since it's axiomatic that reform commonly results in unforeseen problems, and that sometimes these problems can make matters even worse, we should be cautious, by which I do not mean timid, in our approach. We should bear in mind that whatever we do, the main problems of access to justice will continue. Legal proceedings will always be too costly. It's inconceivable that one day we will reach the blessed state where the populace goes about saying that the cost of legal proceedings is about right. There is always likely to be concern about delay. There will always be the phenomenon of an enormous unmet need for legal advice and representation, whether by lawyers or non-lawyers. The great majority of the legal problems in the community somehow resolve or dissolve of their own accord, or they fester without any recourse to advice, let alone action. Life simply goes on. That's the way it always has been, and I imagine always will be. That could be seen by some as reason for apathy, resignation, or even despair. In my view, it need be none of those. It's simply one of the facts of life, like disease, aging, or death. The fact that we will never get anywhere near to conquering the problem does not mean we give up. On the contrary. From some points of view, I would say that things seem to be getting more and more difficult. In particular, the shortage of money increasingly impinges on the conduct of public business. The Conservative government says there is no more money for access to justice. The Labour opposition, not to be outdone, agrees. Yet many of the things that provide better access to justice unavoidably cost money. If there is no more money, or worse, if the amount available is actually reduced, access to justice will suffer. In the coming years, our ingenuity and resourcefulness in finding ways to help citizens to cope with the law and the legal system will be severely tested. This country's strength, however, is that there is a large, and I believe growing, number of people, lawyers and non-lawyers, young and not so young, professionals and volunteers, who have a commitment to improve access to justice for the community. The developing story of access to justice in the coming years will include much to make us frustrated and even angry. But I have no doubt, too, that there will also be reason to feel that in spite of the difficulties, we are able to make some progress, and that we are making a worthwhile contribution to the support of fellow citizens at times of trouble in their lives. Thank you.
Professor Zander will have heard, the warmth of your applause indicates, much better than words of mine, your appreciation of the lecture which has just been delivered. I rejoice in that lecture because it does focus upon the importance of the subject which has been discussed, and I suspect makes everyone in the audience appreciate that there are no simple answers, and that answers which are proposed do require the sort of scrutiny that Michael Zander has provided. I was glad that he chose to deal with the proposals in relation to legal aid before he turned to my proposals. I always felt that I was getting an endorsement by comparison to I will say straight away that if I had any illusions of that, there's no fear of my being misguided as a result, because if my proposals have had any merit, they have been due to the fact that I have had the benefit of LSE in preparing my proposals. And indeed, I'm interested to know that not only that I am here to listen to what Michael Zander had to say, but Professor Cranston's here, who was my assessor, who academic advisor on my committee, and without whose help I would no doubt have received more criticism than actually occurred. The subject is one which, of course, as Michael Zander indicates, is dependent upon resources. And as I'm sure that Michael Zander would accept, somehow resources have to be used in the best way possible. I understand the Green Paper as being an attempt to try and achieve some progress on that front. I appreciate, as everybody will hear, that the form which is proposed in the Green Paper is a debatable one. Equally, in making my proposals, I have had the same concern in mind. I regard the resources as being a matter of the greatest importance. I also regard research and monitoring of the process of change of being the ones which are essential to any sensible advance in this field. I must confess that I am not quite as jaundiced as Michael as to what will be the outcome of the process of change. I think that there are prospects of achieving one improvement in relation to the matter first addressed by Professor Zander in his remarks, and that is the question as to whether or not more access is a good thing or not. As I perceive it, what can be said about the system of civil justice at present is that there is unequal access to justice. And if we could get to a situation where there is greater equality in access to justice, that is something in which we could all take satisfaction. However, that being said, I think it was essential that we heard Michael Zander's comments about the proposals which are now being considered. Like you all, I share your enthusiasm for the way the matter was dealt with, and with such clarity and with such trenchant skill, and I would ask you to display your enthusiasm yet again for what Michael had to say in the normal way. Finally, I've got to tell you that there is going to be a reception after this lecture. I'm told it's a change of venue. It's in the Founders Room, not the Senior Common Room, as advised.
Sixth floor.
The Founders Room is on the sixth floor. Thank you very much.